Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. And here we are at sea in mid-January 2021, in the dark, just days from the constitutionally appointed Inauguration Day. We're unsure what's coming, even what to call this American condition, other than dire. We face, pick your phrase, an American abyss, an apocalyptic unveiling of the real Donald Trump, a pandemic of fear or fraud or farce, a Civil War reenactment or rehearsal of a coup, maybe a revolution. Never was there an American transition of power like this one. From a clear scorecard outcome to denial and dread, resistance, and a theatrical rebellion. At the site being prepared for the ceremony of oath-taking, we've seen instead a warm-up show of defiance, violence, and contempt, all of it cued by the defeated president who is refusing to leave. We grope for understanding this hour with three guests as to where we're at and why. The sage sociologist of race and culture, Tressie Cottom, thinks the breakthrough in Georgia and the breakdown in D.C. are two faces of the same coin. David Blight, who wrote the great Frederick Douglass biography last year, says we're reliving the abandonment of Reconstruction. We begin with the political scientist Steve Van Evera at MIT. He says we should be talking about a noxious radicalism that has taken over the Republican Party and our dominant media.
We got two big problems. One is we have a radicalized Republican Party, and the other is we have a radicalized and I would say destructive rise of a right-wing media, which has given rise to another phenomenon, which is a cult-like social formation on the right wing of U.S. politics.
Measure the problem inside the Republican Party.
Radicalized Republican Party has been emerging for the last 40 years, and you see it dramatically last week when 8 U.S. senators and over 140 U.S. House members voted against American democracy. They voted to overthrow it by voting to overthrow the Electoral College. We've never seen such a thing in modern times. We've seen earlier outcroppings of it over the last two decades with the rise of both tactical and programmatic extremism in the Republican Party. Tactical extremism meaning a rise of doing business in ways that are more like war than normal politics, a rejection of the notion that you compromise with your opponents in the end, that you treat politics as a matter where you compete hard at election time, then you co-govern afterward, and that you maintain some degree of civility in the meantime, that you share power. In the end, our constitutional system assumes that we have a government formed of shared but separated powers shared among the branches, and that requires some willingness to share power and share control in normal governing times. And we've seen the Republican Party depart from that and reject the notion of sharing power and reject the norms that are required for it. For example, reciprocity, civility, holding to the old norms we used to govern by. Like, for example, when Mitch McConnell rejected Merrick Garland for the Senate, despite the Constitution requiring that the president get advice and consent from the Senate on Supreme Court nominees. So we see this tactical radicalization. We also see programmatic radicalization. The Republican Party today basically rejects the New Deal, wants to undo it. It's hostile to Social Security and to the later, you know, Great Society programs, Medicare, Medicaid. This is a new thing. These were accepted consensus programs 20 years ago. And the New Deal was an accepted consensus program, you know, back in the 50s by the Republican Party. So there's been a real radicalization of its goals. Where's that coming from? Where's it going? It's a danger to the country because the Republicans are now adopting a way of doing business that isn't compatible with our form of government or our Constitution.
Steve Van Evera, mark the milestones here. Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan acted like pals. Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton did not. When did the orange warning go to red?
I would say it started in the mid-80s, exactly as you say. If you look back at the way the Republican Party did business in the 70s. They elected leaders like Gerald Ford, who was very civil. He believed in competing but co-governing. Bob Michael was the Republican House leader before Gingrich. Again, at recess time, he and one of the top Democratic leaders, Dan Rastenkowski, they used to drive cross-country to Chicago together. There were always these funny stories about how many steaks they would eat at the steakhouses and all the cattle were at risk when they were nearby. Gingrich was the first outcropping of the new Republican tactical style, which I would say, to sum it up, is treating politics like war. Hmm. Your goal is to exterminate the other side.
Speak of the media piece, Steve.
Well, we have a parallel, shall we say, radicalization event. I date it from around 1986 when the Fairness Doctrine was repealed. The Fairness Doctrine was a federal rule that required that broadcast stations represent both sides if they're going to broadcast political points of view. It gave rise to the new AM talk radio format that still is very successful. Rush Limbaugh, Alex Jones, Michael Savage, the other galaxy of right-wing talk radio. Second big event was the rise of Fox News. Fox is powerful far beyond its viewership. It sets the terms of debate in right circles, conservative circles. Hmm. Fox discovered that you could run a successful business and make money with essentially a programming scheme of telling lies, spreading hate, and sowing division. And it was presumed before that time that the way to win and keep a loyal viewer base to a news station was to tell the truth and be known for it and be careful about making no mistakes. Have integrity. Your viewers want honesty. Give them honesty and they'll reward you. And Fox showed that there was another business model, which I call it the affinity fraud business model.
Affinity fraud.
Affinity fraud, yes. The idea is that the station convinces parts of its viewer base, convinces everyone it can, that the station itself is part of their we group, part of their identity group, that it feels their pain, that it sees the world through their eyes. Mm. And this was the business model basically of the original penny press, the yellow journalism that emerged in the U.S. in the 1880s and 1890s, the New York World and all those guys who, through their demagoguery, helped get the U.S. into the 1898 war. And Hearst was one of the original newspaper owners who invented this business model. For example, Hearst used to do antics that would convince readers that Hearst was a good guy in the world who was out there slaying dragon. He sent reporters to Cuba on a raid to extricate a young woman from a Spanish prison. And then he wrote all about it. But the real point of it was to sort of say to his readers, we're against the same evil people you are. We're a we group here with you. And when you do that, one of the positive effects it has for the media outlet is it hardens your audience against counterinformation that exposes the fact that you're lying. And that's what we see today with the Fox audience. They're impervious to fact-checking showing that Fox is not reliable.
Mm.
This relates to the larger point that you've seen something like a cult form on the American right, a community that is hermetically sealed off, accepts information only from its own inside sources, does not accept information from, shall we say, sources outside of that community.
Wow.
This gets to the more general issue of cults in politics. Are they dangerous? Do they matter? I think whenever you see something like a cult forming, you should, fasten your seatbelt. Hmm. It has the ability to act in a strong and united way because it tends to have a lot of solidarity. And it's impervious to reality checks. Hmm. And that's what we're dealing with today with the folks in Washington, reaching them to make them understand that they've been misinformed very hard, undoing this whole lie that has been purveyed by Trump that he won the election and that there was election fraud. And it's because of the social structure of the folks who follow Trump that they have formed themselves into something, I think a cult is the best word to describe it, into a medically sealed community that will not easily be persuaded to extend information from the outside.
Fascinating, Steve. I mean, we've seen it all without quite noticing what was going on. Hate media that makes money. Also, politics as war that throws out the old standard of comity. I thought comity between the branches was almost in the Constitution and no longer in practice. Where does it go from here?
Well, we need to find an answer to both of these problems. You can't unelect a radicalized media. And here I'm talking about the folks we just mentioned, plus the radical online versions of the extreme media that have emerged since Fox. And I'm talking here about Breitbart and Gateway Pundit and Newsmax, and they have all been amplified by the rise of social media, which has had this unexpected effect of serving as amplifiers for messages of hatred and division and of lies. And I'm talking here about Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, WhatsApp. No one saw this coming. No one believed that this was where social media would take us. It was all supposed to bring us together. The three biggest problems in the United States today are Donald Trump, Rupert Murdoch, and Mark Zuckerberg.
That makes it simple. Who do we run against them? Do we have three heroes to match three villains?
I would say who in the past have shown skill with communication for the cause of good and for the common good, who sets examples that the good guys follow if they want to write the American discussion and the American public sphere and the American terms of debate. If you look back at some of the past Democratic Party leaders, it's pretty simple. Joe Biden ought to go back and study the deeds of FDR, Harry Truman, and Mike Deaver. These were past executive branch leaders who did shape the terms of debate in the U.S.
Mike Deaver, you mean Ronald Reagan's handler?
Yes, yes.
Explain that one.
He sets the gold standard for knowing how to run a White House communication operation. He and Reagan successfully shaped the terms of debate back in the early 80s, often for policies I didn't agree with, but they did it very competently. Deaver understood the principle of repetition. He would basically launch the White House communications effort on a messaging that would go on for months on a single topic, because he understood you don't make an impression on public discourse until you've repeated something many times. He used surrogates, always knowing that we live in a noisy world. The president alone cannot really make an impression by giving one or even 10 speeches. You need to have a surrogate system. So he had the entire government organized around using all media appearances to speak on the same point in the same way. Go back further to FDR, who used the White House very effectively to shape terms of debate in the U.S. And people remember his fireside chats, where he actually treated the American people with a little bit of respect and engaged in some education, which you can do in times of crisis. When the public is really worried about something, they will listen carefully to something beyond a soundbite. Roosevelt understood that and used the power of the bully pulpit effectively. So did Truman through his public actions. He shaped the terms of debate in 1948 brilliantly by the theatrical action that he took to sort of expose how unhelpful Congress was being on getting the economy sorted out.
The do-nothing Congress, yes. And let's look at the record.
Go back and read the kind of stump speeches he gave, way better than what Democrats tend to give these days in terms of toughness and clarity. But the bigger picture was his understanding that politics is theater, that the White House is a stage. The president has a bully pulpit, that educating the public through everything you do is part of your job. Obama, for some reason, never got the memo on the bully pulpit, and neither, frankly, did Clinton or Carter. And Biden needs to learn that lesson. He needs to have a first-class communication operation that makes full and wise use of the bully pulpit to drive the national discussion.
Steve Anibra teaches the science of politics at MIT. Coming up, a sort of drag show in Southern symbolism in that invasion of the U.S. Capitol. It wasn't just the Confederate flag. This is Open Source. Tressie McMillan Cottom has been awarded a MacArthur Genius Fellowship in the few months since we've heard her voice. She's an essayist, lecturer, a traveling sociologist who teaches at the University of North Carolina. Among her specialties is noting the experience and the ideology, the working rules of the road among Black American women, past and present. I asked her to fit the Georgia elections and the Capitol Hill riot into one big frame.
They are related to the same thing. They spring forward from the same well of social, economic, and racial conflict. That really is the conflict at the heart of this nation. Many of the people who welcomed the opportunity to answer President Trump's call to besiege Washington, D.C., and then later to storm the Capitol, were responding to the reality that the organizers on the ground in Georgia had been responding to. They were responding to the reality that this nation has not resolved the tension between a democracy that was built on the subjugation and exclusion of Black people from the body politic, and the idea that this is a white first nation, and that if it is not a white nation, then it shouldn't be a nation at all. That is what the people who are on Capitol Hill on Thursday are effectively organizing under, the banner that America can only be America if it is America for white Americans most and first. And in Georgia, what we saw is part of a long historical narrative, a struggle in organizing for the full inclusion of African Americans in the body politic, and the full inclusion that does not just include, by the way, African Americans. Black organizing has never just been about Black people. It also includes poor white people. our growing Hispanic and Latino population throughout the U.S. South. And what they were saying is that the fundamental founding of American democracy on the principle of our exclusion is a cancer on the American lie of an American republic. And so both of those people, groups of people, are responding to the exact same thing. One, however, is a practical politics of progress, yes, but also one that is more inherently democratic than the other. The people in Georgia were actually practicing democracy. The people who found themselves in Washington, D.C., by choice and by compulsion, were there to quell democracy. And so this has been this sort of never-ending conflict. You know, we're always in this nation fighting the Civil War, right? We called off the battle, but the ideas that animated the Civil War are always ones being litigated and relitigated through our bureaucracy, our political machinery. And that the specter of violence raises its head is precisely because Georgia was successful. Had the strategic disenfranchisement of Black voters in Georgia been able to hold as it had through the last, four or five electoral contests in that state, white rioters wouldn't have felt the need to go to Washington, D.C., because the bureaucracy would have taken care of the conflict by excluding and oppressing the Black vote. It is precisely because the Black vote was able to express itself as a full enfranchisement that the conflict, the specter of violence, raised its ugly head. So they are part of they're the flip side of the same coin. Both sides are fighting for democracy or the idea of a democracy. One is just a democracy of exclusion and one is a democracy of inclusion.
I want to get to how Stacey Abrams did it. She embodies that triumph in Georgia. But first, I'd like you to sort of take us from a Black perspective through what you felt in that Capitol Hill mob. The racial feeling, a lot of it unmentioned, the history, the premises, not to mention the Confederate flag. What was the racial animus you felt or the premise under that gathering?
You know, as I watched Washington, D.C. unfold, I was struck, as I have been many times over the last 4 or 5 years, by the way, with how much of a Southerner I am. Mm. Because as a Southerner, there is something about this place that you can't drop into the racial politics of the American South any more than you can drop yourself into the caste system of India and understand it objectively. It is just such a subjective experience, you know, and you either, I think, come through that experience or you only learn of it and there'll always be a certain amount of distance. And because I am produced by this system, I thought this is the most Southern moment of my recent memory in political communication and medium. I mean, if you take away what we know about, you know, being in Washington, D.C. and it being the nation's capital, you have the Confederate flags flying. You have the flags of the Ku Klux Klan, the groups that sprang up after the Ku Klux Klan was effectively neutered and dismembered. You've got the symbols of Southern white nationalism, but you also have the symbols that the Southern white nationalism calls out to, the symbols of white purity rooted in this fictive, imagined history of white people being descendants from great Nordic cultures and having a natural right to manifest destiny in the nation and the country. There was nothing that I saw in the images that day that quite honestly didn't feel like driving along I-85 or Route 301, which bisects North Carolina and South Carolina as I'm traveling through the more rural parts of the state. But I also think it's important to point out that because this is sort of like an imagined glory, an imagined past for Southern racism, you didn't have to be Southern and you didn't have to be poor or rural to participate in it. What we are learning is something that felt very right and accurate to me, that many of the people who participated in the siege are actually people who have no biological relationship to the American South. No relationship, for example, to the Confederacy. These were Northerners, Northeasterners. These were people from the Midwest, from the West Coast, many of them upper and middle class of great economic means. These are not the people that we think about. And when we talk about, you know, the great economic anxiety of the poor and working class white American, and that just speaks to how powerful the ideas of the American South are for whiteness all over the country.
You see them putting on a kind of Southern white robe.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, it's a costume. It's, you know, they do Southern drag, you know, to call out to drag cultures and drag shows that what they think a white Southerner looks like and acts like and what they affect. And that just speaks, again, how powerful those symbols are, not just to the South, but one of the things that the American South does for the national psyche of whiteness is it does provide, in these moments of racial animus and conflict, it provides them with the symbols that they always pull from. These are the same symbols that white people have pulled from throughout the post-Civil War history of this nation. And that's because those ideas are always kind of kept just there on the back burner, simmering, you know?
Tracy, I got to say, I was shocked in the paper to see a picture of a busload, people who'd put on the drag. Mm-hmm. And they were coming from Newton, Massachusetts. And I wondered, what were they thinking when they play that role? Do you know?
My friends who are gender and feminist scholars would say there is a great appeal to the Southern drag performance. Hmm. There's a visceral thrill in performing a type of masculinity that I think a lot of people, a lot of white people have been told they have been denied by the commie left, by AOC, by the Black radical identity politics warriors, by Black Lives Matter, that there is something that they have been denied. And it is their God-given right to feel masculine power and, you know, captains of their own ship and all of that. And so I don't know that it would have mattered what the exact cause was, so much as that the cause promised them that there would be this moment when they could feel that visceral desire and power of being this hyper masculine figure. You know, I was struck in those images by how many of the people there, men and women, coincidentally, who were dressed in like this paramilitary tactical gear. It's, you know, and that kind of military performance of wearing the camouflage, dressing like a ninja in the all black, you know, with all of the tactical gear.
Viking helmets too.
Viking helmets, you know, that's all a cosplay, a very dangerous cosplay. I don't want to undermine how dangerous and violent it is, but that is what I think is very attractive to a cross-sectional, diverse demographic of white people across this country who have no immediate complaints, you know? They have no immediate appeals to how they have been personally negatively impacted by diversity or feminism, but the idea of them is somehow under threat. And being able to dress up in that sort of hyper-masculine way and have everybody cheering on, it had the entire event had a real jubilant quality to it, even when it became violent. We often talk about, you know, the collective effervescence, sociologists might call it, but something happens when a crowd comes together in one place. And this had a sinister, jubilant quality of those old pictures I grew up watching of white people having picnics at public lynchings. Right? The juxtaposition of the horribleness with the joy that the participants are feeling by being there in fellowship together. This was a moment of fellowship for many people, and it didn't matter what the politics were, what the expressed politics were. It was the offer of this fellowship that they could come there and they would find that visceral thrill. And that thrill, though, is always predicated on somebody else's oppression, is the insidious nature of unchecked white violence.
Come back to Stacey Abrams.
Yeah, I'd love to.
and how did she confront it? Over 10 years, in a methodical way, in the Peachtree State of Georgia.
Stacey is, you know, the most visible and the pinnacle of the personalities, I think the people who will end up symbolizing the change that happened in Georgia. But she is part of a team of organizers across that state that are mostly Black, disproportionately Black women and Black queer people who did not believe the narrative that their state was a demographic write-off, which is how the Democratic National Convention had treated places like Georgia for a very long time. I think they understood a couple of things. They understood that the Republicans won if they could convince people that the vote was a foregone conclusion, that they relied on that belief. And so Stacey got out there very early, first trying to convince the Democrats that the state could be won. And in her own words across many interviews, she says She couldn't get Democrats to believe in that vision. But she's like, I've been out here talking to people and they want something to vote for. But the idea is that their vote won't matter, that it won't count, even if they do go over and above and beyond the voter suppression that impacts them. They don't think anybody will be there to receive their vote. And she said, we've got to rewrite that narrative. And I think Stacey had something that a lot of political operatives don't have that organizers do tend to have. And that's why it's very important that I think she had that spirit of an organizer.
Which is?
Things change. You've got to have a pretty pessimistic view of human nature and human behavior to think that they will always do what they did the last time. And one of the things Stacey was trying to sell the Democratic Party on was that there is something that you can't capture in a poll, and that is what people believe and what they need. And they created an on-the-ground plan that let people of Georgia, especially Black voters in Georgia, rewrite the narrative of their vote. They said, they don't care that we don't show up in your polls. You never called us. You know how many people I talk to, Chris, who've never been polled by a political pollster? You know how many Black communities and neighborhoods there are where no one's ever knocked on their door? I'm a solidly at this point, middle-class Black voter. I'd never been polled in my life until last year, ever. Right. And I think that's due in large part to the fact that last year I moved into a wealthy majority white enclave. And so they knocked on my door for the first time ever in the middle of a pandemic, I might add.
A few conversations back, you used the phrase pragmatic hope as the mark of a generation, but a lineage in Black America. I've used the phrase 100 times since then. You embody it for me. Take that apart. I mean, what you see. And how many Stacey Abrams you feel all around you?
Oh, there's so many. We do not have a poverty of pragmatically hopeful African Americans with the spirit of organizers and the skills and strategy of political operatives, economists, sociologists, political theorists, and what have you. There's no poverty of us. Stacey Abrams absolutely embodies so many. I think about Fannie Lou Hamer, so many of these Black women throughout the civil rights movement, for example, who were critically unsung, whose work of doing actual organizing sometimes ran afoul of the mainstream male-centric civil rights movement symbolism, but who were on the ground talking to people and were doing it in a language that people could understand. Stacey tapped into that historical lineage, which is not just a Black civil rights lineage, but also a Black revolutionary language, and the language and the history of Black women throughout the South who have, listen, who hold up entire institutions and organizations through their daily labor. Stacey saw that labor in a way that I think most of mainstream politics did not see it. People laughed at Stacey. That's when pragmatic hope is its most powerful, Chris, when they laugh at you. When you know what you know and you've seen what you've seen and you have a clear-eyed vision of what the landscape is and everybody tells you you're crazy and you show up anyway. And Stacey just kept showing up and she kept showing and proving. There's not a single thing that Stacey Abrams predicted 5 years ago that she did not achieve over the last year and a half.
You know, people like me love to quote Harold Macmillan in the early 60s, Prime Minister of England. And somebody asked him, a reporter probably, what's going to change the course here? And he said, events, my dear boy, events. And on January 6th, we had two absolutely contradictory events. Where do we go from here? Where do you go from here? Where does your imagination go from here?
You know, my imagination always kind of plays in the field of the radical potential of believing Black people. What would happen if I just believed what Black scholars or Black activists said, especially the Black people who I may not agree with on everything? What happens if I believe them? I think that if Georgia teaches me anything, it is that listening outside of the, you know, the echo chamber that even I can become a victim of is where the real imagined potential is, right? That's where the political imagination is. That's where my creative energies really are these days. I think that what hopefully will be next for all of us, what should be next, what we should be trying for. I like to hearken to the idea of the many Black organizers throughout history who have said, you know, how you live your beliefs is by aligning them with someone else's. This is the time to join something. You know, we've become the anti-joiner culture. We don't like to join. We like to buy, but we don't like to join anything. And in great moments where a lot of events are happening, capital E events, this isn't a time for individuals. This is a time for groups of people, right? You don't have to agree with everything that a group believes in. You don't have to accept all of the tenets of a group, but now is the moment to join a group that shares your big values and beliefs, whether that's on climate change, whether that's on economic inequality, whether that's on gender or sexuality, because all of those things intersect with a form of inequality and oppression that will make everybody else's better if we were to solve it. Find something, join it, and believe in it. So I am working very hard in my daily life to become a joiner, to align my activities and my imagination with other people's.
So interesting. That was on Tim Snyder's list in his little book on tyranny. Join something.
That's right. Join something. Listen, I go to meetings all of the time for a thing where I don't know what they're talking about half the time, Chris, you know, because I don't keep up with all of the emails, but I do. I vetted the organization. This is what I'm going to commit myself to. And so you show up. Really, over half the battle is showing up. Because as we learned with the most recent events, the other side is showing up.
Tracy, I learned so much when I listened to you. I can't thank you enough.
It is always a pleasure talking to you. Seriously, Chris, anytime.
Coming up, scavenging through our history to find our today. David Blight says we all do it, one way or another. This is Open Source. David Blight won the Pulitzer Prize last year for his biography of Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. I asked him this week to pick out the straws in the wind that remind us somehow not of the Civil War exactly, but of its aftermath.
Well, I suppose, Chris, it's because a lot of this is about race.
Yep.
That takes us back to Reconstruction, for those who know even a few facts about Reconstruction. It's also got to have something to do with the fact that this feels existential. And not just because of the event on January 6th, but for the past 4 years. This experiment, this thing, this American democracy has been under attack from within. We now realize, well, some of us realize, that the biggest threat of all is the President of the United States himself. We have never faced that, ever. I mean, Andrew Johnson was a problem for anyone believing that Reconstruction ought to be reshaping something about the American South. He was considered by many radical Republicans a danger to the Republic, but not, frankly, as fundamental, I don't think, as Trump. And also, I guess I'd add to that, that we are having every day, are we not, for those with their eyes and ears open, civics lessons. We're seeing portions of the Constitution verbatim put on television and read back to us. Even Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is now being... No one ever talks about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Remind us.
The 14th Amendment had five sections. The most famous and enduring is Section 1, because that brought about birthright citizenship, due process, and most importantly, equality before law. They may be the most important sentences in the Constitution.
Yeah.
However, Section 3 was all about disqualifying people who had committed rebellion or insurrection against the United States from ever holding office again. That amendment was crafted in the winter and spring of 1866. Many of the ex-Confederate states had sent ex-Confederate soldiers to resume their seats in Congress, including the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander H. Stephens, who showed up as the supposedly elected senator from the state of Georgia. So the Republicans at that time, they were not going to allow these people who had participated in this civil war against the United States to ever hold office again. Now, my only point is the Trump presidency has given us a gift of constitutional lessons, whether it's about impeachment, presidential powers, congressional powers, and, for God's sake, let's not forget, electoral law. I mean, we've never seen so much discussion of constitutional authority this way or that way in my lifetime. And it's interesting, isn't it, Chris, how desperate Americans have been in recent months, years, to find their footing with American history. And I have to say, there's never been a moment when historians have been more sort of on call, so to speak.
Right. Well, thank goodness.
Well, let's hope so, but are only the converted listening? Because that's the other side of this, isn't it? That we've now become a society that really lives in separate universes, universes of truth, universes of knowledge, and universes of constitutional understanding.
David Blight, go back to the end of the Civil War, the failure of Reconstruction, the maybe fundamental unreadiness of a United America to accept Black people as equals in power. And here we are with Confederate flags being emblazoned all over the Capitol Hill. What is it that's so indigestible about our history?
The Confederate flag can mean many different things to many different people, but it essentially means I'm not part of your pluralistic country, your multiracial experiment, and I will do anything to resist federal power. Until I saw some more of these videos of the sheer violence of that attack on the Capitol, it was the presence of that Confederate flag inside the Capitol that I found just so repulsive. And that was in part what prompted me to write that there's a new lost cause, and it just stormed its way into the Capitol.
The lost cause being the romance of defeat and the retelling, shall we say, or the blatant lying about it. But I'm also reminded of the famous Marx line, history presents itself first time as tragedy, second time as farce. There are so many farcical elements of this one. There's not a shred of evidence for Donald Trump's claim, part of the lost cause notion, that he won overwhelmingly the election in November. I mean, how does it sell and how can it last?
It sells because it's beguiling. Look, lost causes or any deep mythology, any vision of the past, to be believed, not unlike Marxism itself, let's face it, it needs to be all-encompassing. It needs to sort of explain everything. It needs to explain why people feel grievances. It needs to explain what the enemies are. And it needs to leave people at the end of the day with a sense of community, a sense of righteousness, and a sense of purpose. And back to your point about farce, when you read about the beliefs of these people, their use of Christianity, their use of conspiracy theories, the whole stolen election manifesto that even members of Congress seem to believe, one can have the first reaction of just sheer incredulity, like these people are nuts. Well, some of them are crazy, but they're not all crazy. These are beliefs. And all deep mythologies, whether they're benign in the end or whether they're very toxic, hostile, and violent, are sets of beliefs in search of a history, in search of a narrative, a story that they can connect to and get traction and grow over time. Now, this is a complicated set of beliefs these people have.
It is an amazingly complicated set of beliefs. What strikes me as incredible almost is the way Donald Trump, not an intellectual, not a reader, not a writer, not a thinker, can intuit and assemble so many little winks and hints and phrases that cohere. Your listing of what Trumpism hates, I think, is worth quoting. This is from your Sunday Times piece. Trumpism knows what it hates. Liberalism, taxation, what it perceives as big government, non-white immigrants who drain the homeland's resources from whole countries, memorably. Government regulation imposed on individuals and businesses, foreign entanglements and wars that require America to be too generous to strange peoples in faraway places. Any hint of gun control, feminism in high places, the nation's inevitable ethnic and racial pluralism, and the infinite array of practices or ideals it calls political correctness. potent ideas, all in search of a history.
Yeah, well, take any five of those. If you really believe those things are threats to your children, to your future, to your livelihood, to your religion, to your country, your God, you'll fight for it.
What if you're an immigrant, child of immigrants, grandchild of immigrants? How can those beliefs sort of smash so many of the things that we, most of us, I would say, live by?
Well, most of us probably still do, but there's always been some degree of immigrants who, by the second generation, want to close off the door. You know, I made it here, I have mine, and you shall do the same. I have an old college roommate. This goes way back to our days at Michigan State. My friend was actually a Ukrainian immigrant. His parents emigrated out of Germany eventually, but we were from the same town, kind of similar background. He called me recently. And we really had it out. And he explained to me why I voted for Trump. And to him, as he said, it had only to do with three words: his personal financial statement. My stock portfolio is the only thing that matters. Now, he would never have joined that mob in Washington. That's just not what he would do. But if I were to talk to him, he'd have some defense of it. And this is the biggest problem we face. There are millions of people out there who sympathize with what happened on January 6th, even though they would not be in the vanguard of cross-carrying, Confederate flag-carrying maniacs who stormed the Capitol. But it's those millions of sympathizers that we have to worry about.
David Blight, come back to the other great event reported on January 6th. Two liberal Democratic senators, one black, one Jewish, elected from Georgia. A model of the pluralism of the country, compromise, organization, enormous personal investment in the day-to-day disciplines of politics. How do you teach that story? Mm-hmm. The story of the 2020s?
Well, I don't know yet. You know in retrospect how you're going to teach it, but here's what I do think. The most important thing that happened in the 2020 election was the Georgia elections. Now it's a narrow, narrow victory, let's not forget. And it took enormous mobilization, especially by the black voters and their leaders in Georgia. And I would argue that the election of the young Jewish Ossoff is just as important as the election of Reverend Warnock. This is a fundamental change in Southern politics. There have always been Jews, you know, in political and economic life in the South, for sure, but not at this level. And what it means is that a state that has become so pluralistic, like Georgia, and down the road, maybe Texas, is a new politics. The Georgia runoff was electoral politics on steroids, as we have really not seen in our lifetime, except with a possible couple of exceptions, maybe 2008 in the Obama campaign. I'm hoping that young people who'd never vote in large numbers, and didn't in Georgia either, by the way, are going to somehow grow up with the lesson here that you want to change the country, you ultimately got to do it at the polls.
Yeah. David Blight, I keep wondering, you're the biographer of Frederick Douglass, the great visionary of Reconstruction, heartbroken by the end of Reconstruction. He had a notion of a composite nation and, of course, an inclusive democracy, as well as the Melville, Pequod, Moby Dick notion of a nation of nations. Mm-hmm. What's he saying about the reemergence of those fundamental questions about who we are, who we're going to be?
Yes, Chris, and I'm glad you pointed to that 1869 speech, The Composite Nation, because it is one of his great speeches. It's not one of his longest, but my God, does it fit our present moment? It was his vision of this multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-racial America, all living, as he said, under the great principle of equality before law. I don't know what Douglass would do now, any more than anybody else, although I do have thoughts on this.
Please.
Well, first of all, Douglass was so deeply steeped in the Hebrew prophets, so steeped in, you know, biblical gospels, he would detest this use of Christianity by the evangelical right and by these radical right fanatics who attacked the Capitol. I mean, all their uses of crosses and all their kneeling to pray and all their uses of biblical passages. Douglass would loathe that. He would probably react by raining fire on them right out of Jeremiah and tell them what's coming for them. I have a feeling Douglass would do now what he certainly did in trying to resist the lost cause. He would resist this new lost cause with equal vehemence. Douglass would do what Douglass always did. He would go back to fundamentals. And for him, his fundamentals drew from the Enlightenment natural rights tradition. If you even go and look at Douglass's last major speech of all, the one called Lessons of the Hour, 1894, it's only a year before he dies. It's the speech on lynching. Even that speech ends with a final paragraph about the power of natural rights, the power of, and he calls it in that paragraph, the self-evident truths of liberty and equality. And he says, what those still need, his words, were the trump of an archangel. That these creeds, he says, will still revive America, will still save America, as long as they don't give up on them. And by the natural rights, he meant life, liberty, equality, the doctrine of consent, that governments exist only by the consent of the governed. He would take us back to fundamentals, and I'm pretty sure of this, he would demand people keep a long view of history.
Would he say, you mean to say 100 years, 120 years later, you're still fighting over these fundamental notions of equality and liberty, inclusion?
Yeah, I'm sure he'd be shocked.
Where did the
he'd
teachers go? What are they telling kids in school, kids in college?
Yeah. As a historian and a teacher now, for years, it does cause one a bit of despair when you spend every day either teaching or writing about these things, and you look around and you realize we've completely rewritten this history for half a century now. We could go on naming dozens of historians who have rewritten this history and have even written best-selling books, and yet millions of Americans don't seem to even know it, and they still don't understand how fundamentally slavery tore the United States apart, how fundamentally the Jim Crow system buried the victories of the Civil War for decades and decades and decades. Even recent history, like the Civil Rights Movement, is a very contested episode in our past now. Look, one other thing here, Chris. So many books are going to have 2020 in their title down the road because of everything from the pandemic to the racial protests to this election and on and on and on. But I hope what's at the heart of it is that one of the biggest achievements of Trumpism and his party is that they actually succeeded in rendering analysis, evidence, truth, and facts irrelevant. That's an incredible achievement if you think about it. We don't even talk about facts and truth anymore as something real. We constantly talk about it as contested or it's alternative or whatever label you want to put on it. And by God, you know, some of us in journalism like you and some of us in universities live by this. We actually do believe there are some truths.
Right.
And when you find them, you're supposed to advance them until somebody refutes it. And then you incorporate that. That's what knowledge and knowledge growth is supposed to be. That has come under such duress that I don't know what parents are telling their kids. I don't know what kids are being taught in sixth grade about this or the eighth grade. They're going to figure it out for themselves, I suspect. But this is something absolutely fundamental to whether a democracy can even function. That there cannot be some basic agreed upon facts Right. And so we've got a lot to solve out of this 2020. And Joe Biden and his team are inheriting possibly the worst situation since Lincoln in 1861.
Wow. David Blight, we're so grateful for your writing and your teaching. Stick with it, man. We've got a lot to learn.
Well, Chris, it's always great to talk to you. And I don't know. Good luck to us all.
Amen. Thanks also to Steve Van Evera and Tressie McMillan Cottom. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks. Mary McGrath wrote our Constitution. I'm Christopher Lydon, and I live by it. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.